Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, June 25th, and I'm your host, Cara Santa Maria. And I want to thank those of you who made Talk Nerdy possible this week, including my patrons who have pledged at top dollar on Patreon. Remember, if you want to pledge your support, you just got to go to patreon.com/talknerdy. You can read about all the different levels there. So this week, I want to thank Rob Schreck, Phil T-Bear, The Zombie Drummer, David J.E. Smith, Jeffrey Perez, Charles Payet, Jonathan Wright, The Honorable Husband, Jafe, Gabriel Felipe Jaramillo Gonzalez, Brian Holden, and Jeffrey Sewell. I know I've been talking about it for a while, but I will have a brand new Talk Nerdy store up very, very soon. In the meantime, you can still visit the existing store because there's a lot of cool stuff there that you can purchase and show your support and offer your support. So thank you so much for all of you who have chosen to do so. Now, this week is an exciting week. Every week's an exciting week, isn't it? But this week I got a chance to speak with a really, really talented author who's telling a very important story. So his name is Michael Lemonick, and he's the opinion editor at Scientific American. But he's written for Time Magazine for several years. He's also written for National Geographic, The New Yorker, and a lot of other places. He's written several books, but his most recent book is called The Perpetual Now, A Story of Amnesia, Memory, and Love. And it is exactly as the title implies, a beautiful story about a remarkable woman living every day with severe amnesia. It's just fascinating. And without further ado, I can't wait to share it with you. So here he is, Michael Lemonick. Well, Michael, thank you so much for joining me. Or do you prefer to be called Mike?
I introduce myself as Mike, but people don't always pay attention and they call me Michael. So I'm fine with either one.
They call you Michael because it says Michael in all your books.
That's that. No, that's not the only reason, because before I wrote any books, they were doing it.
Gotcha. They just have I'm going to break with tradition and call you Mike, as I'm assuming most of your friends do. I am so excited to have you on the show because not only is your new book a fascinating story, it's called The Perpetual Now, A Story of Amnesia, Memory, and Love, but also you have a super cool job. So I want to start with that. You are an editor at Scientific American, but you're specifically the opinion editor?
Yes.
Is that right?
I am the opinion editor. And when I first saw the job posting on an email, I said to myself, I've got a lot of opinions. Turns out they don't care about my opinions. So I am in charge of all of the non-news, non-feature content. So invited editorials, op-eds, staff editorials, the blogs are considered opinion content. Because sure. The bloggers insert themselves. So I'm in charge of bringing in and editing all of that stuff.
That's really cool. And you, of course, have been a science journalist for quite a long time. Is this your first editor position, or have you worked as an editor for a while in the past?
I've worked in the past as an editor. My first job was at Science Digest magazine, which, if you think you've heard of it, you probably are mistaken. because it went out of business in 1986. But there, part of my job was editing freelance writers and part was writing. And then at Time Magazine, I was almost exclusively a writer unless the editor went on vacation, then I had to edit. And I did some editing at Discover Magazine for a while. So it's not my area of most expertise and experience, but I'm doing it anyway.
It seems like, I work mostly in podcasting and television. So although I have to write, I'm writing scripts and, I have a lot of friends, that have been on the show, science writers who are incredibly prolific. One of my best friends, Jason Goldman, he's been on the show multiple times and he writes all day, every day. And it's a skill that requires so much focus. You cannot be as bad of a procrastinator as I am, at least, but it's definitely a very specific skill.
Yeah. Don't be so sure that you can. I know Jason and I like him and I've worked with him. So we have that in common.
That's great. But it's obviously a big shift to go into the editing world, right? Like, I don't know if a lot of people understand the difference between a writer and an editor other than, what the name implicitly entails.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of overlap because as an editor, I am concerned with a piece reading smoothly and conveying information in an effective, accurate way. And, you know, all of the same things I'm concerned about with my own writing. The only difference is that as an editor, my job is to avoid imposing my own voice on someone else's writing. And it's very tempting to do that because I might think to myself, oh, I would say that a different way. And I should not do that unless the piece that I'm editing really is unclear or awkward or ungrammatical. So it's, I don't know what it's like, but there's a lot of overlap. But the other thing that makes it quite different is that when I am writing, I am in charge of myself and only myself. And if I don't get a piece in on time, I'm the one who suffers. So I'm just in charge of myself. If I don't come up with good ideas, too bad. I don't get paid for my work. If I don't get something in on time, too bad. I'm the one who suffers. Whereas as an editor, I am promising my magazine or my platform, I will have such and such a number of stories for you, and they will be in good shape and they'll be ready to go. And then I've got to make other people do it. So that's the difference.
And doing opinion work, it's almost like, well, I guess with a lot of magazines, you're kind of wrangling multiple freelancers.
Yes.
You're not really probably dealing with a lot of people who are on staff. You're the one who's on staff.
Correct. So that's, you know, that makes it tougher in some ways. But the beauty of it is that I get to read and edit pieces from some really interesting people who are really good writers, and also some interesting people who aren't such good writers, but we work on that. You know, everybody from Nobel Prize winners to graduate students to even a high school student once wrote a blog post for me.
And fun.
And they, I learn so much. You know, when I write my own stuff, I learn a lot about things that I'm particularly interested in. With this job, I learn a lot about things I really didn't know about. So
sure.
I'll give you one example. I was at a conference and there was a woman there who was on the faculty of, I think, the UCLA School of Nursing. And I had been explaining to this group, well, what, you know, what makes something a story? What makes something worth talking about as opposed to just dull or something like that? And I can't give a definition, but I said, if you have something that's sort of surprising that people don't really know about, but that they would be really fascinated to hear about, that's a good indicator. And the woman came up to me afterward and said, well, maybe you'd be interested in this. I think most people don't realize that nurses do basic scientific research. And I said, I had no idea. That's really interesting. And she said, well, I'd like to write you an opinion piece or an op-ed talking about that. And that was great. That's a perfect example of how my job surprises me and teaches me. And I have to tell you the best part. She wrote this piece, and in it she mentioned that the history of research, especially in public health among nurses, goes all the way back to Florence Nightingale. So that's interesting. But the fun part is that Scientific American is a very old magazine. I was able to link in her story to a story that Florence Nightingale wrote for us in 1865.
Holy, that's so cool. Oh, that's so neat.
Yep.
Is it hard for you to dig up archive pieces like that, or do you have them? Like, I mean, something like that must be in microfiche, right?
No. It's all digitized.
Oh, that's good.
Buy a subscription to Scientific American, you can have access to our entire archives back to 1847.
Wow, that's amazing. Oh my gosh, what an exciting kind of, I guess, partnership to the work that you do as a writer, and not just writing features or individual print pieces or online pieces, but also this is your seventh book. Am I right about that?
Yes, you're right. Although some of the promotional materials, it says my sixth book because I counted wrong, but.
That's amazing. It gets to that point where you have to calculate how old you are from your birthday. So maybe it's the same thing with your book.
Right.
Okay. So, I mean, before we dive into the book, then I have to ask, how do you even have time to, I mean, it's one thing if you're trying to churn out a few pieces a week as a freelance writer. It's another thing if you're reading and editing multiple pieces a day as an editor. And then on top of that, you're doing all of the research and interviewing and reporting and writing for your own books.
Well, the answer is going to disappoint you.
What is it?
It's that I started this job about a month before this book was due. And so I only had to overlap for a month. There's no way I could write a book now.
That's what I thought. That doesn't disappoint me. It makes me feel way more human.
Okay. No, there are people like that, but I'm not one of them.
Exactly. And there are plenty of people who take hiatus or take sabbatical when it's time to write a book. That's a pretty normal thing, right?
Right, which is what I've essentially always done in the past for my books. Mm.
So sort of in between jobs, or if you're lucky enough to have the security in a position where they'll give you some time off to be able to focus on that. That's good to hear.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. So in looking at some of your previous books specifically, there does seem to be a recurring theme that you had a lot of focus in the past on cosmology, astronomy, physics. This book is a big turn for you, isn't it?
It is. Yes. You're correct in detecting the theme. I have been fascinated with astronomy and physics since I was a little kid. That's what I have done most of my feature writing about. That's what I've done most of my books about. It's really my area of greatest comfort and expertise. Mm-hmm.
And so this is a turn into neuroscience, into psychology, into, you know, I mean, I can't think of a bigger within the sciences, kind of a bigger left turn to go from the vastness outside of the human skull to the vast complexities within.
Right. And the complexities within are way more complex. Seriously. I've written this whole book. I interviewed a lot of people and I read a lot of stuff and I barely begin to understand. I shouldn't admit this. No, I'm now one of the world's experts on neuroscience.
I love it. You know, it's funny because my background is in neuroscience. I did my undergrad in psychology and philosophy. My master's was in neurobiology. I'm now working on a PhD finally as a much older than some of my peers in clinical psychology. And when I first started as a science communicator and journalist 10 years ago, when I was tasked with covering physics and cosmology, I was like, wow, am I in over my head? I have literally the exact opposite experience as you do.
Right.
It's physics just blows my mind. I still get really tripped up when I'm talking about new stories and new discoveries. I have to dig super, super deep and rely on interviewing lots of experts before I even start to develop an elementary understanding of what's going on. But like your book and these kinds of clinical tales, you know, these inspired, very Oliver Sacks-esque stories are what made me want to study psychology and neuroscience to begin with.
Sure.
And I can't help but be fascinated by it. And I think there's something so fundamentally human and real about telling the tale of neurological illness or, you know, dysfunction, if you want to use those kind of negatively valenced words, but how they really do affect the personhood and the experience of an individual human being that, I don't know, it touches you in a way that, at least for me personally, is much deeper than even the grand kind of existential experiences that you have when you talk about the cosmos as a whole.
Oh, yeah. Well, everyone of us, you know, has a personhood and a self, and a, you know, we're looking out from our brains onto the world, and the idea that our reality is constructed by the brain and can be transformed by changes in the brain, it's kind of mind-blowing, as you say. You know, the idea that who I think I am may not be who I am. Of course, everybody is curious and amazed by that stuff.
Oh, for sure. For sure. So I want to know, like, let's dive into this story of this woman that you had to dig super deep into as you were doing all of the research and putting together this book. Her name is Lonnie Sue Johnson. And what happened? Well, first we should say, who is she? And second, what happened to her?
So she is a woman in her, let me think, how old am I? he's about 67 or 68 years old.
Okay.
She was, for her most of her career, a very accomplished commercial artist and illustrator. She worked for a lot of magazines. She drew covers for The New Yorker. She drew book covers. She drew illustrations or package designs for companies. She worked for The New York Times. She was just incredibly successful. So that's how she made her living. She was also a private pilot. She fell in love with flying in sort of middle age and ended up owning two planes. She was a very talented amateur viola player. She was a small businesswoman because she ran her own art business, but she also, toward the middle of her 50s, got involved in an organic dairy, which she ran on her property in upstate New York. So she was this very accomplished, busy, successful woman.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's who she was. And as it happens, and part of the reason I know about this story in the first place, she also went to high school with me.
Oh, wow. So that's your connection to her.
That's my sort of connection to her. I actually never, she was a couple years ahead of me. I never spoke to her in high school. I wouldn't have known her if I tripped over her. It was a pretty big high school.
How were you first made aware of, you know, obviously the crux, which we're about to talk about? Right. How were you first made aware of her and her, I guess, illness or accident?
Yep. Well, so I did know her younger sister, who was one year behind me in high school. We played in the orchestra together. We weren't friends, but we certainly knew who each other were, and I could picture her face if you asked me to. You know, I can still remember her as a middle school kid and in high school. We would run into each other in the supermarket every so often, the younger sister. And I, because she and I both stayed in Princeton where we both grew up. And she's the one who came up to me one day and asked me, have you heard what happened to my sister? And I hadn't. And so she started telling me the story. And that's how I connected.
So you all still lived in the same town where you went to school?
Yes.
Oh, I love that.
Yes.
That's so neat. That doesn't happen very often.
And how much? No, that's right.
How far out of high school were you when you found out about this?
Oh, well, so this was probably about 5 or 6 years ago, and I'm just celebrating my 45th high school reunion. So you can do the math.
Wow. Oh my gosh. I love that. I mean, I love it in terms of just the incredible nostalgia. I love it in terms of the fact that you were so close to home. And I can only imagine that doing the reporting for this story must have, I don't know, been very personal for you. So even though you know, may not have ever been close to this woman, she really was of your homeland.
Absolutely. And because she was so successful, and this is not a big town, you would hear, you know, people would say, oh, have you heard about Lonnie Sue Johnson? She just had a big show, or she's got the cover of The New Yorker. So she was a very well-known local character as a young professional, and people followed her her career. So she was a local mini celebrity.
Sure, because she was just so kind of high achieving and exactly. So successful.
Exactly.
And so then what happened?
What happened was one day in, now I think it was the end of 2007, just before New Year, a neighbor tried to, knocked on her door and she wouldn't answer. And he looked in the window and she was acting very strangely. She had her head on the table and she was looking at the mouse for her computer as though it was a foreign object. And he knew that something was wrong. He broke in. She was incoherent. And another neighbor took her down to the hospital where she went unconscious. And the doctors there suspected, they didn't know, but they suspected that she might be infected with encephalitis, that is a brain infection with a virus. And if that was true, she was in real danger of death or at least very serious brain damage. So they immediately started her on antiviral medications, which saved her life. But when she came out of the – and she did indeed have this viral encephalitis. When she came out of her unconscious state, it turned out that her memory had been almost entirely destroyed. And it's not just her memory of the past, but also her ability to form new memories from experiences going into the future. So she was living in a slice of sort of the present without the ability to learn from experience and learn new people and learn their names and learn anything, and also an inability to remember her past for the most mm-hmm. part. And I say for the most part because her younger sister, Aline Johnson, is very particular that I not give the impression that she literally has no memory.
Yeah. Which is, I think, the kind of the Hollywood impression when similar stories are told.
Right. Nevertheless, she was devastated. The damage was enormous, and she was in a state where she couldn't take care of herself at all. And it turns out that this is not an unheard of situation. So we now know that this kind of infection goes, when it gets to the brain, it centers on the medial temporal lobes, which are the place where our memories are consolidated and stored and processed. So that to form a new memory, you have to have the hippocampus and other tissues surrounding it in the medial temporal lobes of the brain intact, and that's their job. They take your experience mm-hmm. and they sort of tie it together and tie it with a bow, and it becomes a memory. And without that structure in place, as neuroscientists already knew from earlier cases, your ability to form memories is devastated. Your ability to call up memories from the past, especially personal memories of personal experiences, is also essentially gone.
So when we talk about kind of specifically the hippocampus, which you mentioned we know from other stories in the past, like, I don't know if everybody who's listening remembers, but I had Luke Ditterich on the show. We talked about patient HM, right, who's a very kind of important figure in neuroscience. A lot of what we understand about memory came from studies of him. Oliver Sacks did a beautiful short story about somebody with both anterograde and retrograde amnesia. I think it was in The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, but it might have been in An Anthropologist on Mars. And of course, there are Hollywood movies that are kind of brought up about this. I think there was one with Adam Sandler called 50 First Dates,
right,
which, you know, tried to embody this in a comedic way, at least, you know, kind of a rom-com kind of way.
Right.
But I guess I do think it's important to, like, be super clear and debunk some of the confusion about the difference between anterograde and retrograde amnesia, the fuzzy lines between amnesia, and also the causes and the outcomes. So this is so interesting that she was suffering from this brain infection. Most of my understanding of this kind of deep, especially dual amnesia, comes from patients who were alcoholics their whole lives and who had this kind of Wernicke-Korsakoff's disease.
I'm not as familiar with that, although I'm aware of it. But HM, he was not just important, as you say. He essentially and inadvertently founded the modern science of memory because, as you know, and maybe some of the listeners will, he had his hippocampus removed surgically in an effort to stop these terrible epileptic seizures that were uncontrollable. Nobody knew at that time what the hippocampus was for. They thought it was kind of a minor organ within the brain. And it was by what happened to HM, which was almost exactly the same thing that happened to Lonnie Sue Johnson, although by different means. He had, until he died in 2008, essentially the same deficit that she did, with some variation. But when HM woke up from his surgery, people suddenly realized, oh my God, that's what the hippocampus does.
And then we could, of course, do experiments in animals,
yes,
and we could see it, you know, in ability to remember mazes with mice and rats and all that good stuff. But seeing it in a human, being able to ask them about their experience,
yes,
is really telling. And looking at their journals, oh my goodness, so telling.
Yes, absolutely. The man that Oliver Sacks wrote about had, again, the same condition because his hippocampus was destroyed. But in his case, it was encephalitis, like Lonnie's.
Mm-hmm.
And so there have been cases, some cases are caused by head injury, but most, because we don't do that surgery anymore. Most are caused by encephalitis now, but there are only a handful in literature. And so I knew about HM because I studied him in freshman psychology in 1971 when I went to college. And I was I was haunted by this idea. And I read about Clive Wearing, the man Sachs wrote about. And here I was being presented with a chance actually to talk to and write about somebody in this same condition, not read it in a textbook, not read it in an Oliver Sacks article, but actually experience being with somebody like this and trying to understand her world. And that's why I leaped at the chance to write the book.
Oh, it's just fascinating. And of course, if anybody's interested in looking up Korsakoff syndrome, this is just what happens when somebody drinks so much throughout such a long portion of their life that they have a thiamine deficiency. It's a vitamin B1 deficiency, and it causes what they call Korsakoff syndrome, which is actually kind of an encephalopathy that targets the mammillary bodies. And so you end up with both anterograde and retrograde amnesia, but also some other kind of brain damage or brain illness associated symptoms. And so, yeah, through this, whether it be through encephalitis, whether it be through prolonged alcohol ingestion, whether it be through physical damage to these structures, we know that when you mess with the hippocampus, you have a really hard time encoding new memories. But you also, that's the part that's so interesting, you have this thing called retrograde amnesia, which is the amnesia I think most people are familiar with. Right? Yeah. That like you bump your head and now you can't remember things that happened to you in the past. Right. Anterograde means obviously you've damaged the structure that's necessary for encoding memories so deeply that you have a hard time forming new memories.
Exactly. And in fact, you know, when I first met Lonnie Sue Johnson in her amnesic state, she seemed perfectly normal. She smiled, she welcomed me, she asked my name, asked me a few questions. And then I had to go out of the room for a minute to talk to her sister. And I came back and she greeted me again as though she'd never seen me before in her life. And this happened repeatedly over the several years that I did the reporting for this book.
And so, of course, the question that comes up for most people is, are these people aware of their illness, or are they constantly having to be reminded? Because it's one thing to say, oh, we met previously, I know you don't remember. We've met previously, I know you don't remember. But is it that every time you say, oh, we met previously, I know you don't remember, you have this amnestic illness that they are experiencing the existential terror of realizing that something happened to them every waking moment of the day?
Well, that is a very good question. And the answer is, it depends. So Clive Wearing, the British musician who had encephalitis back in, I think, the 1980s, the one Oliver Sacks wrote about, was in fact in constant terror. He didn't know where he was. He didn't know what was happening to him. His diary is truly terrifying because he will write, you know, a whole page. I'm finally awake. I've been asleep and now I'm awake. I don't know where I am. 30 seconds later, now I'm really awake. Now, but what's going on?
Waking up for the first time ever in my life.
Whereas with Lonnie Sue Johnson, for reasons we don't really understand, maybe the damage was not exactly the same because it's not super specific to each cell. You know, different parts of the tissue can be damaged more or less.
Yeah, it wasn't excised like in patient HM. It was just damaged. So there's probably still some underlying normal function,
even HM, it was his hippocampus was excised, but you know they were doing it blind. They didn't get literally the hippocampus and nothing else. So it's never exactly the same damage, just very similar. And whereas Lonnie Sue Johnson never seems upset, she doesn't mind not knowing what's going on. She's very cheerful. She's very upbeat. She's very optimistic. It's not, oh my God, what do you mean I've met you before? This is terrible. It's like, oh, that's so nice to meet you again.
I love that. And you know, it's interesting because it makes you wonder how much of that individual variation is secondary to fundamental personality traits? How much of it is secondary to the extent of the damage in the hippocampus? How much of it is secondary to the extent of the damage in other areas of the brain?
Exactly.
You know, to take a small diversion, early in my psychology training, I saw an individual patient who was who had damage to his frontal lobes, and that damage came from a suicide attempt. And you know, in essence, he basically underwent a frontal lobotomy. So prior to the attempt, he was incredibly depressed. But after the attempt, although he had shattered his optic nerves, although he had no functional vision, and he basically lost his face. He didn't have a nose, he didn't have teeth, and it was a series of reconstructive surgeries. And he very much looked scary at the beginning of those reconstructive surgeries. He was blissfully unaware of any history of depression. When you would ask him how he lost his, you know, how he got his brain damage, he would say, oh, I must have been cleaning a gun. I can't imagine how it would have gone off. He just had no concept of the fact that he could have ever been depressed. And he was so happy. Like, he had no realization that he looked scary or that people might give him different looks. That it's like the damage to the brain itself fundamentally changed his personality. And it was just so interesting to see a really bright young man, a really high functioning young man who happened to have this very severe damage in a different part of his brain, who was just so happy and so, I don't know, interactive. He was just a joy to be around.
Right. Well, so here was the other thing about this opportunity that I had. Clearly, so I'm writing, in essence, a biography of this woman, but she doesn't remember anything about her past. So,
oh, yeah, that's quite the task.
So, I mean, obviously what you do is you talk to people who knew her before the illness. I talk extensively with her mother and sister, who had been her primary caretakers after she left the hospital, but who had known her her whole life. I talk to people who had known her as a young artist. I talked to her ex-husband. By the way, she was married for 10 years. She has no memory whatsoever of having been married.
Wow.
I talked to colleagues of hers. I talked to old friends. So I talked to people who knew her in the last years before the encephalitis when she lived up in Cooperstown, New York. And I was able to put together at least a somewhat consistent picture, which suggests that this sort of warmth and ease with people was a very fundamental part of her personality beforehand. Mm-hmm. So,
that's
yeah,
cool.
So her personality, I think, really did inform who she would become after the encephalitis. The essence of who she is actually isn't much different. But as to your question about her awareness of her condition, no, she's not really aware of it. It knows that she has a few memory problems. That's what she'll say. If you say, how's your memory? She'll say, well, it's not terrible. I do forget things sometimes. She has no concept of the profundity of her disability.
And of course, I think that when we first started learning about severe kind of dual amnesia, both anterograde and retrograde, we had this idea, and maybe even my formation of this idea came from the short story that Oliver Sacks wrote about a very different man who did have this existential terror every day of his life. But we think of the fact that our memories really are who we are, and without our memories, that there's a strong sense of loss of personhood. But it sounds to me like she really maintained quite a bit of her personhood.
Well, in fact, the working title of this book, before I got into the reporting very much, was The Woman Who Lost Herself, because I felt just exactly as you just described, that the essence of who we are is in all the things that have happened to us, and the memories and the associations and the all of that. And she doesn't have those, so she must have lost herself. Well, by the end of the book, I felt entirely differently. I had to change the title for that reason. And yeah, it did make me question my whole understanding of why memory is important and what it's really for.
Yeah, we are more than our memories, even though conventional wisdom or, you know, philosophical musings or even earlier neuroscientific case studies would tell us otherwise.
Exactly.
All right, guys, I want to take a quick break to thank our sponsors of this week's episode, starting with a new sponsor, Lightstream. And Lightstream offers an easy way to save money. If you right now are dealing with debt on a credit card, you can lower your interest rate with a credit card consolidation loan from Lightstream. They reward customers who have good credit with great interest rates and no fees. And you can get that credit card consolidation loan from 5.89% APR with AutoPay. Their loans run, you know, from $5,000 just to help out with some expenses you've had all the way up to $100,000 for a really big project. And you can choose your funding date as soon as today. What I love about the website is it's super, super easy to use. They're great calculators, so you can determine exactly what your monthly payments are going to be based on your loan amount, your terms, how you're going to pay it, and what your APR is. And of course, they offer loans for everything. It's not just debt consolidation, home improvement loans. You want to put in a swimming pool, maybe add solar panels, help with adoption expenses, medical expenses, and almost everything else you can think of, like horse loans. Yes, there is such a thing as a horse loan. You learn something new every day. And guys, as listeners of Talk Nerdy, you get an additional interest rate discount on top of Lightstream's already low rates. The only way to get this discount is to go to lightstream.com/nerdy. That's lightstream.com/nerdy. Subject to credit approval. Rate includes 0.5% auto pay discount. Terms and conditions apply and offers are subject to change without notice. Visit lightstream.com for more information. I also want to thank Jamf Now for their support of the show. Jamf Now helps you set up, manage, and protect your Apple devices on demand. And of course, it's pretty easy to keep track of your own, you know, Mac, iPad, iPhone, whatever you've got. But what about all of the other devices in your organization? As your business grows, so do all the iPhones in people's pockets. So do all the MacBooks that people are carrying around. And it becomes increasingly harder to manage them all. This is especially true if, like me, you employ people from all over the country. You employ freelancers who are working from home and, you know, signing in from different locations. But with Jamf Now, you can check real-time inventory. You can configure Wi-Fi and email settings, deploy applications, you can protect sensitive company data, and you can even lock or wipe a device from anywhere. You don't need any IT experience. This is very important. Jamf Now manages and protects your devices so you can focus on your growing business. And as a listener of Talk Nerdy, you can set up your first three devices for free forever. This is such a good deal. And after that, you can add more for just $2 a month per device. So I don't know what you're waiting for. Go to jamf.com/nerdy. That's jamf.com/nerdy and create your free account today. All right, guys, let's get back to the show. And so, you know, what was it like experiencing, I mean, obviously this story is about Lonnie, but it's about much more than her because it's about her relationships. It's about her family. It's about her sisters and her parents. And because you had to do this reporting by seeking out other sources, which any good reporter would do anyway, but you really had to rely on them in this case, you got a very holistic picture of this woman. What was it like uncovering all of this information?
I'm not sure how to characterize that.
I mean, was it heartwarming for you? Was it frustrating? Was it like, did you ever just experience like bouts of depression yourself when you were starting to uncover this? Or was her kind of personality so positive and warm that it kept you feeling quite optimistic during the process?
So as to that latter question, yes, every time I encountered her, I end up feeling elevated by the experience, mm-hmm. just because she's just really, really charming and happy. And she really, when she says that she's glad to see you, she is really glad to see you. Your appearance in her mother's house or in the place she's staying now is like the greatest thing that's happened to her. And it's genuine. So it was extremely uplifting. It was also extremely rewarding and positive to talk to all the people who knew her at different stages of her life, who described this person who was so ambitious and talented and focused and driven, and yet was somebody who everybody wanted to get closer to. She just drew people to her. And I found that consistently to be true. The frustrations happened because, in part because Aline Johnson, her younger sister, is fiercely protective of Lonnie Sue's privacy, and also, and not just her physical privacy now, but the privacy of her personal life before the disease. Mm-hmm. And so there were questions I wanted to know the answers to that really she didn't really want to talk about very much.
Yeah.
That is Aline's, the sister. And so I had to be careful about pushing too hard, and I had to sort of find out some information that she was hesitant to give me. And I, as a biographer, you have to be very intrusive, but I don't like being intrusive. So there was that tension. There was the tension of, well, you know, do I try and track down a couple of people who are probably important to the story, but who Aline thinks, you know, maybe I don't need to talk to, that sort of thing.
Yeah. And it's hard too when you are kind of relying on her, I don't know, her significant others, her family members to give you consent.
Yes, 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 absolutely. I could not have done this at all without the consent and help of Aline and their mother, Maggie Johnson, who, by the way, was 90 years old, I think, when her daughter was struck with encephalitis, and who was one of her two prime caretakers until she herself died at 97.
Wow.
And this woman was as remarkable as her two daughters. She herself was a very successful artist. And, you know, I interviewed her at great length, well into her 90s. A few weeks before she died, I saw her at the gym lifting weights. She was 97 years old. She had driven herself to the gym. Her mind was crystal clear. She was an extraordinary woman. As well. So it goes in the family.
That's incredible. And so she was her guardian until she died, or was her sister her guardian?
The younger sister, I don't know what the technicalities were. They were sort of co-guardians, but I believe Aline, who had, I mean, more energy, obviously, than a woman in her 90s, although not that much more, I think she was the one who was the main, you know, the legal guardian and the executor and all that stuff. She had the power of attorney. So she was kind of the lead guardian, I guess you could say.
Because, of course, even though her personality remained intact and she was a warm and loving character who lit up the room, she still was devastatingly deficient in certain areas. She really couldn't fully take care of herself.
No, she could not possibly take care of herself. So she owned this farm up in upstate New York. There's no way she could live up there by herself anymore. They had to sell the farm. She couldn't have done that. She couldn't have possibly done that. She couldn't have gotten all her financial affairs in order. She couldn't have followed the copyrights on the artwork and all of the stuff that went into being the woman she was. So, yeah, she could not live on her own.
So what were some of the, I don't know, the things that you learned? I think that we have this archetype in our minds of the memory patient, but then, you know, going in and spending day after day with her family, digging up clues from her past. What did you learn that really surprised you? And I think maybe painted a more human picture. You know, what were some of the experiences that you noticed about her, things that she did remember, little awakenings, for me, what I'm always fascinated by are like, what are some of the skills or the tools that they use in their everyday life to try and like adapt and become more independent or more functional?
Well, okay. All great questions. So I should say that part of this book is about the scientific research that's going on with her as a subject. There are a number of neuroscientists who are actually studying her the way people studied HM. And they are particularly interested in her case because, unlike HM, who was basically, he was so debilitated by epilepsy before his surgery, he never had a career. He never had hobbies that anybody knows about. He was not very well read. And so there were certain, obviously he was a normal human being, so he had a normal memory function, and they could study the basics of that. But Lonnie Sue, with her, all of her creative talents and the fact that she was had expertise in at least three different areas, the art, the music, and the flying, which is a very complex skill, and you have to know an awful lot to be a private pilot. Mm-hmm. There were many more subtleties of memory that the scientists could test with her.
And also there's, you know, I think the conventional wisdom, at least, is that in neuropsychology, is that the higher your premorbid functioning, the better chances you have, even in the face of devastating or debilitating illness or injury.
That's probably true. And she did retain her ability to play the viola.
Oh, cool.
And to create art. So she can still do drawings and watercolors. So this is intriguing to the neuroscientists who have never had somebody with this range of pre-existing talents and expertise to look at. And one of the scientists said to me, you know, honestly, we don't really know how she can do everything she can do, given her condition.
Wow. Does she do it just because she wants to, or does she require, kind of like in the post-encephalitic patients who, of course, had like a form of Parkinsonism in Awakenings? A lot of people, even if you haven't read Oliver Sacks's book, Awakenings, you may have seen the film with Robin Williams and Robert De Niro. And these patients who, of course, had devastating memory issues, but also these motor disabilities, they would have these moments of awakening where if they heard a song, it might trigger them to be able to dance to it, even though they historically couldn't move on their own. Or, you know, if they experienced something that was very personal and meaningful and emotional, like music or poetry or art, they might have these little glimmers of their previous lives. Was she triggered in that way? Or could she just pick up the viola anytime she wanted and play?
Well, you know, the answer is a little complicated, but it's a very good question. So basically, for the first 8 or 10 months after she emerged from the encephalitis, first of all, the disease made her brain swell, and it actually made her unable to walk, unable to talk temporarily, in the immediate aftermath of the illness. And as the swelling went down and her brain sort of returned to all normal, except for the damage, she was able to talk, and she had to relearn how to walk, and she had to relearn how to feed herself. And all of those things came back, largely because Aline and Maggie, her sister and her mother, worked day after day tirelessly to kind of make her practice these things. It's not mm-hmm. clear how much she would have recovered without their efforts. But her mother, Maggie, was not only an artist, but an art teacher, and she had been Lonnie Sue's first art teacher. And she knew what pleasure drawing had given her daughter. And so she was determined that Lonnie Sue would draw again. Lonnie Sue was not that interested. She was not motivated. She would not pick up a pen. She would not pick up a viola. If you put the pen in her hand and put the pencil on the paper or the pen on the paper, she would draw something.
Huh.
But she had no motivation. So she had the ability still, but she just had no impulse to use them.
Were her drawings crude or in any way affected, or was she still, it was like you saw real talent, but you almost had to push her into it?
It's the latter. She still had the talent, just had no interest. And then a very odd thing happened that nobody could have imagined or predicted. And this was about 10 or 11 months after the encephalitis. Lonnie Sue had always loved words and wordplay, and she loved puns before mm-hmm. the illness, which didn't seem to be relevant to anything. And I'll try and condense this. One day, Aline was taking a walk and ran into an old friend who lived in the neighborhood. And this woman had gone on to be a puzzle writer. She created the word search puzzles where you've got like a grid of letters, and embedded within the grid are words that you find in a circle.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And they might be on the diagonal, and they might... Anyway, she heard the story of Lonnie Sue. She said, oh my God, it's terrible. I wonder, would she like some word search puzzles? And Aline's reaction was, sure, I guess. Well, you know, why not? And so this friend gave her the puzzles, and Lonnie Sue started to work on the first puzzle, and it transformed her. She worked on the first puzzle. She worked on the second puzzle. She finished the book. She finished the second book. This was all in a day. She was obsessed with doing these puzzles. It was the first time people had seen her excited about anything since the illness. And she asked her mother to go get her some more books from the store. And Maggie couldn't do it that day. She had to wait another day. And Lonnie Sue could not wait. So she started creating her own word search puzzles. And gradually, very soon, she was illustrating the puzzles with drawings. And the drawings got more and more elaborate. And this became her new mission, to create these puzzles. And she's still doing it to this day. And so basically, it's as though her brain was searching for something where she could put her creativity into it. And somehow these words and the using these words in her drawings gave her that impulse, that thing to focus on. Because she had been a very type A personality. She worked all the time. And now she didn't have anything to work on. Suddenly she did. And even to this day, she carries around a bag with her full of paper and pens, or pockets stuffed with pens and pencils. And wherever she alights, she will take out the paper and start working furiously on these puzzles. It has given her life a structure that it didn't have for the first year after her illness. And it's now, I don't even know, it's, what year is this? It's 10 years later, and she's still doing it.
I can only imagine that not just neuropsychologists and neuroscientists, but like creativity researchers must be so fascinated by sort of the kind of dual or even multiple track thinking that is exhibited in her behavior, you know, yes, and her interests.
Absolutely right.
It does seem, though, as unique as her experience is, it does seem like there is a theme that we see a lot of times in these case studies, that having something that triggers a deep interest or a passion, as long as that person can kind of find that flow, they actually can maintain sustained attention, which is quite difficult for somebody with anterograde amnesia. You know what I mean? To sustain attention is hard, but they have to be in it, and something is getting them to be in it.
Exactly. And that is what these puzzles do for her, or it seemed to do for her. I mean, another thing, you talk about creativity. HM, one of the things they learned about memory from HM is that we have memories that are, we talk in a colloquial way about muscle memory, things that you can do, they're skills that you don't really think about. So when you ride a bicycle, you just ride a bicycle. You don't think about what leg goes here and what you press first and where you don't know what angle you turn the handlebars in to make it. It's just, you feel it. It's in your body. And what I learned with HM was that even though his conscious memories had been devastated, the ability to learn a new skill was still there. So he couldn't learn new facts, but he could learn new skills. And the skill that they taught him on was looking in a mirror and tracing the image of a star without looking at his hand. So, you know, it's very difficult because if you're looking at your hand in a mirror, it's doing the opposite of what you think it's doing.
Yeah.
But if you practice, you get better at it. And in fact, he got better at it. And he told the researchers after a while, he said, you know, I'm so surprised because I'm not bad at this, but I've never done it before. But of course he anyway, so, but that's a very sort of simple mechanical thing. The question they had with Lonnie Sue was, can she learn a new piece of music? Can she improve on a piece of music by practicing it? And unlike drawing while looking in a mirror, playing the viola, reading music and playing the notes and playing them in the right tempo and with the right intonation and vibrato and all and feeling. And it's a very complex cognitive task. Could she improve on a piece of music she'd never seen before? And they knew she'd never seen it because they composed it for her. And sure enough.
And so what? She could do it?
Yeah, she hit every time they put the sheet of music in front of her, it was like, oh, I've never seen this before. But she had, and she actually got better, which tells them that it's something more complicated than simply a mechanical task that you can learn. And so, and they're just at the beginning of this research. So the questions that they're going to ask about her memory function still have to be asked. They haven't even asked the questions. And I have to say one other thing that I learned that was fascinating was that her sense of humor is fully intact. So,
which is crazy because it seems like you need a good memory to have a sense of humor.
But more than once, I was present at testing sessions with the psychologists and neuroscientists where they were putting her through some round of testing, and she would crack a joke, and they had to stop the research because everybody was laughing so hard.
Wow. And were these jokes that were somehow embedded in her memory, or were they jokes that she was kind of making up on the spot?
Is it right? They were jokes in that, you know, what are the, you know, a horse walks into a bar, something like that.
Yeah.
They were mostly plays on words and puns.
Cool. But that means she had a deep understanding of like linguistics and of the fact that words can mean multiple things in multiple contexts.
Absolutely.
I mean,
that's
amazing.
I remember once we were walking into a testing session where they were going to put her in an fMRI and look at her brain as she did certain tasks. And I was walking next to her and she looked at me and said, well, what are we going to be doing now? I said, well, they're going to be taking pictures of your brain. It's really amazing. And she looked at me and said, my brain or the pictures? And I said, well, actually both. she liked that answer.
I love it. That's great. Oh, that's so cool. Okay, so I know we've been talking for a long time and we've got to start wrapping it up. But one thing that we didn't touch base on that for whatever reason, personally to me, it's really fascinating is the tricks and the shortcuts, like the little things that people who have suffered traumatic brain injury utilize in their lives to help them become more functional or more independent. Did she have things labeled in her house? I mean, what kinds of things did she need to do so that she could at least get by a little bit easier?
Well, so one thing she did was to she lives now in an assisted living facility. Mm-hmm. So she has her own room, but it's, you know, in a larger institution. And one thing that became really important to her is that, as in places like this, there's a schedule. On Monday, it's Monday, at 10 o'clock you have water aerobics. Then at 11 you have lunch. Then at 1 you have basket weaving or whatever.
Yeah.
And this gave her a structure around which to organize her day. You would say, well, so what are you doing next? She said, I don't know. Let me look at my schedule. And she would look at her schedule. And that was her external memory device. But the other thing is that she actually organized her room and organized a work area, making these elaborate, she made these series of cubbies out of old milk cartons where she could put her pens and her pencils and organize by color and by size and by it. And so one half of a room is entirely covered with shelves with milk cartons on them, with the tops cut off and on her desk. And so she's got this elaborate system. She's created this world centered around her puzzle making where it's all, she just has to look and see and, oh, here are my red pens, here are my yellow, here's my graph paper, here's my, but nobody did this for her. She organized it herself.
And it all makes sense to her personally.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
It's almost like as kind of a synesthesia. Like when you talk to people who have who are calendar synesthetes and they just have this fundamental organization where they're like, well, yeah, I mean, March is always yellow and, you know, the calendar moves right to left in a twisting form and right. Tuesday has like a green shimmer and it's just things go where they go. Like you just know that that's how it's organized for you personally.
Right, right. And nobody else necessarily understands her system, but she really does.
Cool. Oh my gosh. I mean, that's one where like, that's a dissertation right there.
I know. I mean, that's the really, the beauty of this, that of her case for scientists is that there's so much to look into. They can't, you know, they're just chipping away at it bit by bit. And the answers they get lead to more questions. But this research is going to be ongoing for quite a few years, indefinitely. And if she lives to 97 like her mother, they will have quite a body of work.
And of course, it sounds like as both a subject and a human being, her experiences are not only are they rich and fascinating, but they're deeply personal. And although obviously it makes perfect sense that there are people in her life, like her sister, who want to protect her, who want to make sure that she's not poked and prodded too often, to, you know, that her dirty laundry isn't aired, Of course, that's what a loving, I think, a loving family member would do. It does sound like there's a certain amount of willingness to let people learn from this experience. That's just such a deep gift, I think, to the world.
Oh, right. And so you know, as you know, we never knew HM's name until after he died, because he was so protected. It was only his initials. And right from the start, Aline and Maggie, the mother, decided that they wanted people to use Lonnie Sue's full name, because they wanted her story to help people understand the complexity of the brain and the fact that we need to understand it better. And in fact, one of the few new things that Lonnie Sue has learned, because they've repeated it so often, is that the research that's being done on her could ultimately help other people. Mm-hmm. And that has been their motivation. So yes, they think it's really important for this story to get out and for people to understand that the brain is this very complex organ, and that through research we can understand how it works and find ways to help people who have brain injuries or other brain illnesses.
Oh, okay. Quickly, I have three more questions. I'm going to keep them tight. But the first one is my last question related to the story. A, does she read? And B, has she read your book?
Oh, very good question. Aline keeps me posted since the book is published. She has started reading my book.
What? Is that like the most meta and insane situation ever?
I mean, she cannot, you know, because of her memory problem, she can't really read it in a normal way. So she'll open randomly to different pages. And Aline tells me that her she's got a bunch of post-it notes at different pages that she wants to return to. And the front cover's all smudged. Aline sent me a photo because she's got pencil dust on her hands all the time. So. And yeah, it's not clear what she's getting from it, but yeah, she reads and she is reading my book.
And she knows it's about her.
Because her name is in it. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. And she knows her name. Like she's aware of her personhood, even though she doesn't have many memories.
That's right. And she's aware in a general way of her biography. So she knows that she used to fly a plane. She knows she used to live on a farm. She knows she used to work as an artist, a professional artist. I think she knows that she grew up in Princeton, New Jersey.
But does she know that she's sick?
She knows she has a few, you know, memory problems, but not a big deal. And actually, as a neuroscientist explained to me, that this is not surprising. She's missing this huge, huge chunk of her previous consciousness, but she doesn't remember that she once had it. She doesn't remember what it's like to have a functioning memory, so she doesn't really miss it.
I can only attempt to empathize with the experience of, well, why would there be a book written about little old me and then uncovering things, but of course then losing the thread over and over because the sustained attention can only last so long. Gosh, oh my gosh, there's so many things I would love to keep talking about. But of course, that's why this book exists. Guys, you can pick it up now. It's not even just in hardcover anymore. You can get the paperback version. I'll say it one more time again at the end, but it's called The Perpetual Now, A Story of Amnesia, Memory, and Love. So Mike, I always close the podcast by asking my guests the same two questions. And they're really big picture, kind of deep questions. And I would love to get your perspective. Always excited by the unique perspective of my guests. So you ready for that?
Sure.
Okay. So I want you to think about the future. And I want you to put your mind in whatever context is relevant to you right now. It could be the future of your work, your next project, the future of kind of humanity, of big global issues, of the universe. You've spent a lot of time talking about cosmology. Whatever's relevant to you right now. The first question is, I want you to tell me what is the thing that most preoccupies you? What's keeping you up at night? What are you most, you know, concerned about? What's bumming you out? But then on the flip side of that, so that we do end on a more positive note, what are you genuinely optimistic about? What really does break through the cynicism so that you can say, gosh, I'm looking forward to this. I really think that things are moving in the right direction.
Well, you're asking me this at a peculiar time because my daughter is getting married in just about 2 weeks.
Oh, how exciting.
It's very exciting, and it's stressful, but in a good way. So I am consumed with that. I'm very happy about it. boy, there's a lot of work.
Yeah.
Quite on the cosmic level. It may come as no surprise. I'm genuinely pessimistic about the future of this country and of democracy and of what we assumed about what the United States was and could be, for obvious reasons. I think there are some worst case scenarios that could be really bad. The fragility. Everybody has always we've convinced ourselves that individual politicians may come and go, but the fundamentals of our country and our democracy are strong, and they will withstand any assault. And I don't know that I believe that anymore.
Yeah, we have a lot of executive power in this country, and especially when you have individuals who are making decisions to really test those limits. And diplomacy, I mean, sometimes it doesn't even have to have anything to do with legislation or with decree. It's just bad diplomacy can have devastating
outcomes. Right. And, you know, the things that we thought were limits are not necessarily limits. And so we've got to rethink all of that. And I'm genuinely afraid of what could happen.
Yeah. So that's fair. I mean, I think a lot of people feel the same way you do. Yeah.
Well, I mean, for me personally, I am optimistic that unless we have a nuclear war next week, there's always going to be something new and fascinating and mind-blowing and challenging to learn. That's the beauty of what I do professionally, is that even if I retire from Scientific American, which will happen at some point, there will be no end to the science and the people doing science and the people experiencing science. No end to things I will be able to learn about and write about, which is kind of reassuring.
And so exciting.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
Oh, well, Mike, this was such a fascinating chat. I learned so much. There's so much more to learn, guys. Pick it up. It's The Perpetual Now, a story of amnesia, memory, and love. Mike, thank you so much for joining me today.
Well, thank you. You are a great interviewer. I really appreciate it.
You're so kind. And everybody else, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.